The European Union is changing, so should Labour reevaluate its attitudes towards it? Edward Sturton investigates in Analysis at 8:30. But now on Radio 4, the return of the investigative history series Document. This week, Mike Thompson examines a soldier's memoir, which sheds new light on Britain's true role at the start of the Irish Civil War.
In December 1921, Ireland's revolutionary leader, Michael Collins, signed the Anglo-Irish Treaty. The deal fell well short of full independence from Britain, and some of his fellow Republicans called it a sellout. A few months later, anti-treaty rebels seized the historic Four Courts building in central Dublin, and civil war followed soon after. That much history records.
Well, this is the way to the archive, where we look after all the personal papers. Basically, we look after things like letters and diaries and memoirs.
I've come here to the Imperial War Museum archives in London, home to more than 18,000 documents, to look at evidence that isn't in the textbooks. It suggests that Collins had more help from the British military to crush his former comrades in arms than has ever been acknowledged before.
Look inside this blue folder here, titled Lieutenant P. Creek. We see the title, One Man's Story, Early Days and Life as a Soldier by P. Creek. So this is it, and I'm joined now by William Sheehan from the Open University. Could you tell me how you came across this and take us through it?
My research was looking at the experience of the British Army in Ireland, and particularly the experience of people on the front line. Went through all the papers and I got this collection out, and I had to reread it again to kind of understand what I was looking at. And what Creek is saying is that he was at the Battle of the Four Courts, which actually took place during what's called the Irish Civil War. It's actually the opening battle of the Civil War between what were termed pro and anti-treaty forces. Now, we've always known that the British government gave a lot of material assistance to the new National Army in terms of weapons and ammunition, but we've never known that British soldiers were actually present, if you like, at the first battle of the Civil War.
Before you say any more, William, can we take a look now at this file and what was written by P. Creek?
Okay, so this is essentially the document by Percy Creek, who at this time, when we're looking at the pages here, is a Lance Bombardier in the Royal Field Artillery. So just the first rung up past the enlisted ranks. And he's sent to Ireland to join a battery in Fermanagh, which is in Northern Ireland. And when he's there, the battery receives orders to move to Dublin.
And so they. I don't remember how long it took us to reach Dublin. We marched by night and were told to speak to no civilians and to keep as quiet as possible. We reached the outskirts of the city. I don't think anyone had a very clear idea of what was happening. I heard a little rifle fire. After a while, an officer said to our sergeant, "Who have you got on your gun?" "New man, Creek. He was a number three in France. And Clayton, an experienced gunner," replied the sergeant. "Good," said the officer. "The left section are going into action." So the two guns went into the Battle of the Four Courts. We dropped trails on a grass verge. It appeared that some black and tans had stormed and captured some buildings of the courts and were using rifles to hold their position. The officer came and pointed out one of the buildings. I laid the gun on it, over open sights. The officer checked, and then told the sergeant he was not to order fire until he saw the flag, which the officer was holding, drop. We didn't have to wait long, and I heard fire, and pulled the firing lever, and then saw the shell rip into a wall of one of the courts. They all became quiet, and I think the officers and dignitaries were all very tense. We only fired two rounds, and quickly limbered up and went back to the rest of the battery.
Here you have what would appear to be British troops in action at the Four Courts alongside the new National Army, alongside Michael Collins' new National Army.
That's Michael Collins, the leader of the National Army, the hero at that point, and even to this day for many people in Ireland, known for his resistance to Britain and for winning
independence for two-thirds of Ireland, actually his forces in league with British soldiers.
It's hard to see how British troops could have operated in Dublin in this way and been part of the attack on the Four Courts without senior members of the new National Army, like Collins, like Richard Mulcahy, knowing that they were in Dublin.
If Collins did use British soldiers to help defeat his former comrades in arms, it would have been considered gross treachery, not just by them, but possibly even by many of his own supporters. We've been doing some digging at the National Archives and found an official report on the Battle of the Four Courts. It seems to contradict Percy Creek's account. In it, General Macready, Commander-in-Chief, Ireland, states, "Mr. Collins, having declined the offer of the assistance of British troops, the only help given to the Free State forces has been immaterial." So, which is it then? To find an answer, I need to take a closer look at what was happening in Ireland at this time, with the help of Richard English from St. Andrews University, author of Irish Freedom.
During and after the First World War, Irish nationalist opinion intensified, and the pursuit of Irish independence from Britain was fought out in a war of independence between 1919 and 1921, when the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, and the political party Sinn Féin fought against Britain to pursue an Irish Republic. But within this nationalist movement there was a variety of different opinions about what was acceptable and what was not. And so when a compromise was offered by the British in 1921, embodied in the Anglo-Irish Treaty of that year, there was a split within the nationalist movement about whether this compromise was acceptable. The compromise offered effectively dominion status for a newly established Irish Free State. It had considerable freedom, but there were some restraints. People in the proposed Irish Parliament would have to take an oath of faithfulness to the British monarch, which Republicans in Ireland did not like. And though it was less important at the time to nationalists, there was the issue that the six counties of what became Northern Ireland were not included in this independent state. So in 1922 you saw a split between the pro-treaty forces, those who, like the great revolutionary leader Michael Collins, felt that while this was an imperfect offer, it offered a substantial amount of freedom and the basis for more freedom in the future. And those on the other hand, like the politician Eamon de Valera or the more militaristic IRA man Rory O'Connor, who felt that the treaty did not offer enough and should be resisted. And this is where the Irish Civil War emerged. In April of 1922, Rory O'Connor and others within the anti-treaty IRA took over the Four Courts building in the centre of Dublin as a direct challenge to the authority of the newly established Irish Free State.
So the rebel seizure of the Four Courts threatens not only the Anglo-Irish Treaty, but also the country's newly elected Free State government. The British, who are busy withdrawing their troops from Ireland, leave Collins' Free State government to regain control. But events affecting a retired military man from Ulster, who's by now MP for North Down, change everything. Keith Jeffrey is Professor of British History at Queen's University Belfast and biographer of Henry Wilson.
Henry Wilson is an astonishing figure. He's an Anglo-Irishman who reached the professional head of the British Army at the end of the First World War. He was Chief of the Imperial General Staff between 1918 and 1922. Over a period when the First World War was won, and also over a period when the Irish War of Independence was at its height. But he becomes a great symbolic figure, representing, as it were, Protestant, Orange, Loyalist Ireland. And by extension, he's a trophy target for dissident Republicans.
And what a trophy he turned out to be. The Times, June 23rd, 1922.
Field Marshal Sir Henry Wilson, MP, was murdered yesterday at the door of his residence, 36 Eaton Place, by men who fired at him at close range when he was about to enter his house. Two men, believed to be connected with the IRA, are under arrest. After the murder, the assailants made desperate efforts to escape, armed with large service revolvers. They kept up fire on their pursuers until they were overpowered.
Henry Wilson's assassinated at about 2:30 in the afternoon. At 5 o'clock in the Cabinet Room, 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister and a number of ministers gather for this. And not only are they worried about the immediate effects for this, but in fact a man from Scotland Yard brings the actual revolvers used. So they're sitting on the table. It's a sensationally dramatic moment. But they assume at this moment that the people occupying the forecourts, Rory O'Connor, who'd been there since April indeed, were ultimately responsible for the thing. And they immediately drafted a letter for Lloyd George to write to Michael Collins to say that the forecourts must be quashed. The British government couldn't allow the intolerable situation to continue. And in that letter, on the 22nd of June, the afternoon Wilson's assassinated, they also offer artillery to help the Irish reduce the forecourts.
Given that the Free State Army had no big guns of its own, or training in how to use them, such help was vital. But I'm looking at the same letter sent by Lloyd George to Michael Collins on the 22nd of June. And, as in General Macready's report after the battle, there's no mention of British troops being involved. Not only that, but Creek's memoirs contain several other discrepancies. He talks of travelling to Ireland on a late summer's day, yet the Battle of the Forecourts was in June. He says that the Black and Tans were inside the building, yet the Black and Tans, far from being Republican rebels, were actually controversial paramilitary units of British ex-soldiers who'd been used to suppress revolution in Ireland. I evidently need a second opinion on Percy Creek's memoir. So I brought it to Katrina Crowe, Head of Special Projects at the National Archives of Ireland. So what's your reaction, having seen those papers?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I'd love to read the rest of the memoir. He writes very well. I mean, you can see that. But it's quite scrappy. That's why I'm saying, what corroborating evidence do we have? Is there anything in the regimental records that tell us that part of them were asked to go to Ireland? We're looking at a small number. It does look like a clandestine operation. It's unclear whether they're being posted to Fermanagh was for any good reason or not. Why were they there? They did nothing once they arrived. Were there other troops in Fermanagh at the time? We have his word for it that he fired a gun twice at the wall of the forecourt. The sergeant seems very happy to have him. He says, thank Christ you're here. The other people I have are not... He just says they're Irish, which is synonymous with inexperience, clearly, in terms of using these big guns. So, I mean, what reason would he have to lie, I suppose, is the thing you ask. He's very distinct about the fact that it's the Battle of the Forecourts. On the other hand, he's mixed up about the Black and Tans and the Civil War and all of that. I wouldn't take it as an unmixed, accurate source. I would look for other corroborating evidence.
In front of me, I have Creek's military records from the Army Personnel Centre in Glasgow. They state that he re-enlisted in the Royal Field Artillery after World War I and was stationed at home from 1921 to 23, attached to the depot in Woolwich. He mentions in his memoir that he went to Fermanagh in Northern Ireland, but that's not on his record. We contacted the Royal Artillery Museum in Woolwich and they told us the 7th, 14th, 66th and 4th Howitzer batteries of the Royal Field Artillery relocated to Ulster and Dublin in the summer of 1922. Sadly, we do not have any nominal roles for these units.
One of the things that kind of adds veracity to his account is that in fact he's been up in Fermanagh in Enniskillen. And they didn't use artillery during the Irish War of Independence. It wasn't that sort of war. But up in the border, in the first week of June, there's a thing called the Battle of Belleek, where artillery is used against some dissident Republicans who occupy a strong point within the new Northern Ireland, and they mobilise artillery there. And he appears to have been part of that unit. So, again, that fits in also with what we know about the disposition of artillery guns in Ireland at the time. The Percy Creek memoir is written sometime after the event. In his memoir, he's not, in fact, sure who's in the forecourts. He seems to think it's the Black and Tans. You know, so there's a fallibility to this. But his precise memory of firing the gun had a kind of smack of authenticity. He was there, he was a gunner, he helped them fire the gun. But that is something which would, at the time, and indeed for some time afterward, be literally political dynamite.
As Keith Jeffrey says, the stakes were very high. If it's accurate,
our document reveals that Colin Side took a huge risk, relying on the old British enemy to defeat their former comrades. If they were seen to be fighting with him, it would probably have utterly discredited this iconic leader and united the country against him. And it does seem that Creek's unit was where he said it was, making his claim to have been with that howitzer battery in range of the besieged forecourt building quite credible. So, what happened next?
I've come to Dublin, to the forecourt building, and 90 years later, and despite much major renovation of this large granite building, you can still see the signs of the shells that hit it. I mean, I'm putting my hand here over a rather large indentation in the wall, and there are several others within eyeline here. You can see bits of masonry, bits of granite that have been patched up. And I'm standing here in the company of William Sheehan of the Open University and Liz Gillis, author of The Fall of Dublin. Now, if I can take us back now, Liz, to just after the assassination in London of Sir Henry Wilson. What is happening here now?
It is very tense here at the minute. You have the anti-treaty forces are well entrenched in the forecourt. There's been pressure now put on the provisional government to get these men out. However, the pro-treaty forces, most notably Michael Collins, he is reluctant at this minute to act against these men. These are still former comrades and no one wants civil war, but there is a lot of pressure being put on, especially considering who Henry Wilson was.
So what material help is the British government offering at the moment, and what response do they get from Collins?
They're prepared to offer anything. The problem is, of course, some of those offers do come with conditions attached. You can offer tanks, but only British servicemen know how to use them. You can offer howitzers, but only the British gunners know how to use the howitzers. So they are prepared to offer anything, because for their principal concern is that Ireland will descend into anarchy, that Collins will fail to restore order, and they'll have to do it. For the British government, they thought that they had everything wrapped up with the treaty, and now Ireland is back on the cabinet agenda. They have to deal with it, and they're in constant touch with Collins during this period. Collins cannot lose.
How does Collins respond to these offers?
London is engaged in a series of crisis meetings on the 28th and 29th. There's a to and fro in all the meetings. Collins is...
We have some documents
which he does signal his intention to take the howitzers and the British gunners and to allow them to participate in the assault on the forecourts. So what they say here is that information was just received before the meeting. The provisional government was willing to employ British gunners and to utilise 60-pounder guns. And this essentially is where we've been led from Creek's document. And at that point, we have to remember as well that Collins is under incredible pressure, and he also has Alfred Cope alongside him, if you like, the physical presence of the British government alongside him, keeping that pressure on him as well. Dublin cannot fall from a British perspective.
Remember, it's not just Ireland that this is happening. Like, Britain has her dominions. The dominions are watching. The empire really is at stake here. So they have a lot to lose if that building, if this battle goes the wrong way. It's not just Ireland that's at stake.
For a contemporary version of this nail-biting barrage, here's the account of an anonymous young brigadier in the Free State Army. He gave the following description to the Galway Observer on the 1st of July, 1922.
Two storming parties were under arms at 3:30 that evening, and half hour later the great attack was launched. The artillery opened the assault. From Bridge Street and Hammond Lane, the field pieces sent a torrent of shells crashing against the huge structure. A moment's silence, and then, before the boom of the big guns had died away, raking volleys of machine gun fire peppered the forecourts.
Finally, they decide to surrender. The Republicans decide to surrender. What happens? Talk us through that.
Mines are all scattered throughout the building, and one way or the other, the mines go off, the dome explodes, another massive explosion. On the afternoon of the torches, the men realise that they're not going to hold out. Are they all going to be killed? And you've got 170 men in there. You're not going to willingly let those men die, so they come to the decision to surrender.
William, what's the reaction from London to all this when the forecourts finally falls and the surrender takes place?
So there's a huge sense of relief, and then a sense that they should certainly not be seen to talk about it. And Churchill actually addresses the Parliament, and there's a report in the Manchester Guardian on it. And before the rising of the Commons night, Mr. Churchill, in reply to requests from various quarters, communicated such information as had then come to hand concerning events in Dublin, supplementing his statement with a somewhat apologetic explanation that those matters were the business of the Provisional Government and not our business in the first instance at all.
Rather incredible after all that's gone on, isn't it? All the communications between the two.
Churchill's been up for 2 days trying to deal with the problem, and then he goes, well, it's not really our business.
We didn't have to wait long, and I heard fire and pulled a firing lever, and then saw the shell rip into a wall of one of the courts.
If we can go back to our document now, William. So in these final days when all this was going on, where was Percy Creek?
He doesn't really reveal the location of the guns in his memoir. All he reveals is that they did move from Fermanagh to Dublin, that they could see the forecourts, and that they fired on the forecourts. But I think it's important in that it kind of completes the loop of, or the sequence of documents, that, you know, we have this to and fro between the British government and the Irish government. And in an absence then later on from Irish or English official sources to an extent, and then Creek's memoir being the kind of resurrection of the idea that British soldiers were present and allowing us to kind of explore that possibility again.
They all became quiet, and I think the officers and dignitaries were all very tense. We only fired two rounds and quickly limbered up and went back to the rest of the battery.
At the time, there was a controversy along those lines, and the occupying anti-treaty forces alleged that the bombardment was being conducted by British forces.
No smoke without fire. Michael McDool works in the forecourts today as a senior counsel and is a former politician with the Progressive Democrats.
In fact, the Irish Times newspaper carries a contemporaneous statement by the Free State Army saying that reports that the barrage was being conducted by British troops are untrue, and naming the specific officers in charge of the individual batteries that carried out the bombardment by way of refutation of the suggestion that this was a British bombardment or that the Free State Army were only nominally involved.
But it's possible, though, that some of what they said, not the officers they named, but some of what they said was actually true, that in fact some British officers were involved in that.
It's quite possible that if the batteries were handed over for use against the forecourts, that Collins, as a pragmatist, would say, look, my fellows need a bit of assistance with all of this equipment. That's quite possible. That if there were British NCOs or privates or lance bombardiers or whatever assisting in the operation, they were doing so by way of assistance.
Well, one thing that may bear out what you're saying comes from General Macready, the most senior British Army officer at the time in Ireland, and he says that Collins was offered British troops and actually declined them.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me, and it certainly wouldn't surprise me that Macready's official record says that, because it would be catastrophic if that was not the case, that there should be a record of it that could be published. And to allow the British to conduct the bombardment would have been an appalling risk for Collins, because if it turned out that his denials in the newspapers and all the rest of it were false, it would have been a gigantic scandal for him.
Given the potential propaganda disaster of bringing in British gunners, is there another possibility could account for Michael Collins' denial that his forces had the help of British gunners like Lance Bombardier Creek? What if Collins didn't know? I put this to his biographer, Tim Pat Coogan.
I don't think you could do anything of that nature without Michael Collins knowing. He had omniscient knowledge of things. One of the reasons that he mistrusted the British during the negotiation was they started setting up the Northern Police Force, which was in breach of the treaty, without telling him. And he showed them the letter that they were sending round and said, look, you can't do things like that in Ireland without my knowing it. Now, you couldn't put British soldiers in with some of his closest colleagues to shell some of his former colleagues without him knowing it. That would be impossible. That wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have taken kindly to it, and he would have been at pains to keep the British connection as quiet as possible. He would not have welcomed anything by the minimum of force being supplied by the British.
So if it happened, Michael Collins would have known about it. Do you think it happened?
I simply don't know. I would say it could have happened, given the conditions of the time. I can't see it happening, but nor, on the other hand, can I see it happening without him knowing it.
I think for some people, the idea that Michael Collins might have authorised the use of British soldiers to fire on his former comrades in arms is
Michael Collins
highly
was the least sentimental person
indeed
that ever lived. He didn't give a damn about that. I mean, you know, Michael Collins sent people out to shoot guys in front of their wives and kids on Bloody Sunday, and he was sanguine enough about that.
Katrina Crowe again of the National Archives of Ireland.
He had to be pragmatic. Of course it was difficult having to tackle people that he'd fought with, people like Ernie O'Malley and Rory O'Connor, who were in the forecourts for those 3 months. But he knew it had to be done. And if it had to be done, then the thing was how best to do it. He was a highly ruthless intelligence operator during the War of Independence. He was a very good minister for finance in the first Dáil. He died young, and it was very sad, but that immediately adds to the heroic, wonderful image that people want to preserve. And you're bang up against one of the founding myths of our state, this lost leader who tragically got killed.
So, strip the myth from the man, and it's entirely feasible that the pragmatic, unsentimental Collins went from using British weapons to British gunners too. But after looking at the evidence, historian John Regan of the University of Dundee has a different explanation. He suspects that all this was less about what Collins did than what Whitehall wanted.
All states have foundation myths, and the foundation myth of the southern state is that its origins are in a clear and simple democratic process, that the treaty was accepted by the majority of the population, and that the Free State regime was defending democracy when it attacked the four courts, okay? Creek's document complicates that because it reminds us that the Civil War's origins are to be found also in British pressure. The British want and need the treaty accepted, and they're looking for a means to end the Irish Rebellion. Creek's evidence as such suggests that the British were absolutely there at the moment, the origins of the Civil War. It may even suggest that the British fired the first shots of the Irish Civil War. It's certainly open to that interpretation. And that complicates the narrative of the democratic origins of the state. It reminds us that the British placed enormous pressure on Irish decision makers throughout 1922, from the very signing of the treaty, signed under duress. They held the proposition over all Irish decision makers that if the treaty were not accepted, the British would return and fight, if necessary, a war of reconquest here. Creek's document is at the tail end of that whole process of coercing the Irish state into being.
At the end of all this, it's hard to be absolutely sure what really happened. But if Lance Bombardier Percy Creek's account is true, and British forces were known at the time to have been used, even in a very limited way, by Michael Collins, Anglo-Irish history might have taken a very different path.
Document is presented by Mike Thompson. The readers were Robert Blythe, Patrick Brennan, and Paul Stonehouse. The producer was Neil McCarthy.